15. Congratulating Putin. In March, President Trump told other aides that he was considering firing his national security adviser, H.R. McMaster. And John Kelly, not a fan of McMaster's style, leaped to line up replacements. Before long, news of the president's intentions leaked to the media. The White House denied that McMaster was on the chopping block, but Trump again told aides McMaster was going to be fired, and the cycle repeated. During this period, the mood inside the White House verged on manic. The president was emboldened, buoyed by what he viewed as triumphant decisions to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum, and the plans he was putting together for a historic summit in June with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Tillerson was not the only recent casualty to be humiliated. On March 12th, White House aides had witnessed the sudden firing of Johnny McEntee, the president's personal assistant, booted out by Kelly and escorted from the White House grounds after his security clearance was revoked amid an investigation into his personal finances and links to online gambling. "Everybody fears the perp walk," one senior White House official remarked. "If it could happen to Johnny, the president's body guy, it could happen to anybody." On Sunday, March 18th, this was the soft ground on which McMaster was standing when Vladimir Putin was re-elected president of Russia. It was a frigid night in Moscow as Putin strode onto a stage erected just outside the Kremlin walls to accept his victory. The Russian government said Putin won in a landslide, with more than 75% of the votes, with high turnout thanks to an extensive propaganda campaign. All day, Russian state TV broadcast images of long lines of Russians waiting eagerly to cast ballots for Putin at polling places from the beaches to the mountains to remote settlements in the Arctic. A Russian on the International Space Station was reported to have cast a ballot while in orbit. "Success awaits us," Putin told supporters. "Together, we will get to work on a great, massive scale in the name of Russia." The boisterous crowd responded with chants of "Russia! Russia!" Unsaid was the fact that the Russian election was anything but fair. The most popular opposition leader challenging Putin, Alexei Navalny, had been barred from the ballot. Another opponent, Communist Party candidate Pavel Grudinin, had been relentlessly attacked by the state media, which Putin and his cronies controlled, and finished a distant second with 12% of the vote. It was, as the BBC dubbed it, the election Putin could not lose. Back in Washington, Trump monitored the election results and swelled with pride for Putin. He was impressed by the size of his victory. A mandate. Trump told McMaster that he wanted to call Putin to congratulate him. McMaster was used to hearing Trump toss impulsive ideas into the air to gauge his reaction, but he knew Trump was adamant about this one. He was calling Putin. The next day, in their regular Monday meeting, McMaster tried gently to steer Trump away from the idea of congratulating Putin. He explained that the Kremlin would use the American president's words to claim the world's leading democracy had blessed their rigged election. McMaster suggested Trump condemn the Salisbury nerve agent attack. He also suggested Trump bring up the conflict in Syria to try to protect civilians from Bashar al-Assad's attacks on rebel strongholds. Trump listened, but mostly remained adamant about making the call. So McMaster reached out to Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, and set a time for a call between the two presidents on Tuesday, March 20th. Later that Monday, March 19th, in a prep session ahead of the Putin call, Trump again told his advisors that he wanted to give Putin an attaboy on his election victory. McMaster had resigned himself to the high likelihood that Trump would do whatever he wanted on the call. This is how it went with Trump. This call was Trump's idea, and his whole point was to congratulate Putin, said one White House advisor. HR couldn't stop him. McMaster made one last attempt to give his considered advice. He had his National Security Council staff prepare a 3-inch-thick overnight briefing book for Trump, which the staff secretary delivered to the president's residence late Monday evening. Notably, the briefing book included 4 5-by-7-inch cue cards, the kinds used by students cramming for a test. The stock-grade cards, with the White House seal at the top, contained easy talking points Trump could use in the conversation. To ensure the president would not miss what it said, the first card had all capital letters and bold lettering. Do not congratulate on election win. It was the first time anyone on the White House career staff working on national security could remember a president being handed marching orders from the NSC in all capital letters. On Tuesday morning, McMaster called Trump at his residence for a quick check-in before the call. McMaster did not reiterate the "do not congratulate" instructions from the cards. He didn't think he had to. After all, the key points were in all capital letters. How could Trump miss them? Shortly thereafter, the White House Situation Room placed the call, connecting the Kremlin to Trump's residence. Trump opened his conversation with Putin as if greeting an old friend, congratulating him on his amazing election victory. Trump ignored the first cue card in its entirety. Then he ignored the others. He did not say a word about what Britain had concluded was the Putin-ordered poisoning of a former KGB agent in England, declining to confront the Russian strongman in defense of America's oldest ally. Trump and Putin spoke for roughly 40 minutes, with Trump following his gut and riffing with Putin about how the two of them might generate economic deals between their two countries. Putin had developed a knack for manipulating Trump, making him believe that the two of them could get big things accomplished if they ignored their staffs and worked one-on-one. National security aides feared Putin knew how to feed the unusual combination of Trump's ego and insecurity to cultivate conspiracies in his mind. He told Trump his ideas were brilliant, but warned him that he could not trust anyone in his administration in Washington to execute them. "It's not us," Putin had told Trump. "It's the subordinates fighting against our friendship." As he did reflexively when talking to foreign leaders, Trump invited Putin to come to Washington for a state visit. This was one of many Trump tics that befuddled McMaster. Typically, invitations were extended strategically and only after considerable internal deliberation about the possible diplomatic and policy gains. But Trump invited everyone, creating headaches for his team. Some major migraines ensued when Trump invited the leaders of tiny nations, such as Prime Minister Dr. Keith Rowley of Trinidad and Tobago, and people deeply controversial in their own home countries, such as Brazil's then-president Michel Temer, to drop by the White House whenever they were in town. Trump had been scheduled to speak with Temer in March 2017, and at the time, the Brazilian president was embroiled in a major corruption scandal. Before Trump and Temer's call, White House aides foresaw what might happen and preventatively urged Trump not to invite the Brazilian leader to Washington. Trump did it anyway. White House aides spent the next few weeks politely dodging calls from the Brazilian ambassador, who was trying to make good on Trump's invitation and set up the visit. In the case of Trinidad and Tobago, Trump's invite to Rowley forced the NSC staff to create polite ways to withdraw the offer, explaining that Trump was so busy he could not find time in his schedule to see him. The morning of March 20th, after hanging up with Putin, Trump made his way to the Oval Office. He was excited. He told McMaster he wanted to put out a statement right away. The president liked to dictate what he considered the historic successes of his conversations with foreign leaders for public distribution by the White House. Staffers tried to suggest edits, but it usually fell to McMaster to talk Trump out of ideas that would reveal too much or piss off Western allies. On this day, Trump was adamant about what he wanted the statement to say. "I want Putin to come here," Trump told McMaster. "Yes, Mr. President," McMaster said. "We'll start working on it ASAP. Let's announce the invitation and put out a statement about it," Trump said. McMaster didn't think Trump should publicly announce his invitation, much less have Putin visit Washington at all, but figured the situation could be managed. He explained to Trump that state visits or face-to-face meetings of this magnitude should be kept secret until closer to the event, and after the two countries negotiated a concrete agenda. Trump seemed to relent, shrugging his shoulders. McMaster instructed Fiona Hill, the Russia specialist on the NSC, to contact the Russian ambassador and start talks about a possible meeting. But he stressed that she should take her time. If she set up a meeting with the ambassador, they could say they were working on the visit the next time Trump asked. As McMaster was drafting and editing with his staff the White House's statement on the Trump-Putin call, the Kremlin released its own readout of the call. The Russians almost always got their statements out before the Americans, which allowed them to shape the global media narrative on their terms. The Kremlin's statement made clear what Trump had said. Donald Trump congratulated Vladimir Putin on his victory in the presidential election, the statement began. It went on to say, "Special attention was paid to making progress on the question of holding a possible meeting at the highest level. In all, the conversation carried a constructive, businesslike character and was oriented toward overcoming the problems that have piled up in U.S.-Russian relations." British diplomats, talking to their own sources, were incensed. They were hearing that Trump never raised the issue of the poisoning of the former Russian and British double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, who had defected to the UK. They called their American contacts at the State Department and in the White House, demanding an explanation. For her part, British Prime Minister Theresa May chose intentionally not to wish Putin well, still waiting for him to acknowledge the poisoning. Her spokesperson told reporters May wanted to have independent observers assess the Russian election before she commented on it. The Russians had not exaggerated or misstated the substance of the call, as they often did, and Trump was hardly shy about confirming the truth. Sarah Sanders told White House reporters in the early afternoon that the Kremlin readout was accurate. Later that day, the Washington Post first reported that Trump ignored his "do not congratulate" instructions. The scoop posted at 7:16 p.m., and it blanketed cable news the rest of the night. Washington's national security professionals and Russia hawks were outraged. Late that Tuesday night, Fox's Sean Hannity spoke with Trump by phone, part of their ritual of conferring each night after Hannity's broadcast. Trump told aides that Hannity had a lead about the Judases in his midst, McMaster's deputies. A nor'easter rolled over the mid-Atlantic early Wednesday morning, March 21st, dumping 6 inches of snow on the Washington region, the heaviest snowfall of the season. Metro shut down a large portion of its bus and subway service, and federal agencies in Washington closed, except for essential services. McMaster and other national security staffers reported for duty, and they received a frigid reception at the Oval Office. Trump was furious and demanded that McMaster find whoever shared the detail about the cue cards with Post reporters. McMaster told Trump he too was furious at the leak and told him he had already begun the hunt. The president made clear he wanted an answer soon, hours, not days. Trump and McMaster were not the only officials infuriated by the unauthorized leak. Kelly shared some of Trump's frustration about the unrelenting negative press coverage of the administration and was irate that confidential briefing materials had become public. He, too, directed a search for the sources. Kelly and the White House lawyers put the search in the hands of a trusted McMaster deputy who had never accessed or reviewed the classified notes, according to the White House's digital system, which tracks who opened or reviewed sensitive documents. That deputy, ironically, was one of the people Hannity had accused of being a leaker. On Capitol Hill, Republican lawmakers shared in the outrage. "A president's staff shouldn't leak," said Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican who sometimes criticized Trump. "In cases of principle, you may need to resign. So resign. Do the right and honorable thing if you believe your conscience is compelled to do so, and resign your position." Later that afternoon, Trump called McMaster back to his office. "Did you figure out who did it?" the president asked. "No, sir," McMaster said. He laid out his strategy for the investigation. They had determined that roughly 100 people would have had access to the notes, not counting more far-flung diplomatic staff, so it would take some time. He said they had one idea for catching the leaker, but White House lawyers worried it wouldn't be foolproof and might risk identifying the wrong person. "Well, I know who did it," Trump announced, surprising McMaster and a handful of other aides in the room. "It was your guys." There is a dispute about whether Trump said their names aloud then or later. But in other conversations with senior White House staff, Trump would explain that Hannity had fingered Fernando Cutts and Ely Bajraktari as the leakers. "Get rid of them," Trump bellowed. "This is fucking outrageous." McMaster, who steadfastly refused to fire people based on unfounded suspicions, tried to calm Trump down by saying neither man could be the leaker. "They would never do that, Mr. President," McMaster said. "Never." The next day, March 22nd, the snowstorm continued to complicate commutes. Federal agencies were delayed in opening by 2 hours. McMaster was at his home at Fort McNair, on a peninsula on the edge of Washington, where the Potomac and Anacostia rivers meet. He had meetings that afternoon with his national security counterparts in the Quad, the strategic alliance between the United States, Australia, Japan, and India. He was hosting a dinner that night for them at his home. At the White House, McMaster's skeletal staff, those who had come to work that day, were concerned when they learned who was walking up the snowy main driveway to the West Wing just before 4 p.m. It was John Bolton. "He wasn't being very discreet," said one McMaster aide, noting that Bolton walked past television camera crews on his way in. Bolton, a wily old hand from the George W. Bush administration who was known in those years for his hardline neoconservative views and bureaucratic brawling, was being buzzed about as a contender to replace McMaster as national security advisor. Trump admired him, in part for delivering what McMaster never did, fiery performances on Fox News defending the president. McMaster's aides were suspicious Bolton had come to pay Trump a visit. They asked Ivanka Trump and Hope Hicks, his communications director who was in her final days on the job, to find out what was happening. The NSC staffers wanted to try to stop Trump from firing McMaster without any warning. Ivanka and Hicks talked to the president and persuaded him not to tweet fire McMaster, as he had Tillerson a week earlier. They argued that the military officer deserved more respect, at a minimum, the courtesy of a phone call. Amid this hubbub, Cutts felt he had to do something. For the first time in his years of working in the White House, he strode directly into the chief of staff's office without making an appointment. He didn't seem to realize this clock couldn't be turned back. "I need to see the chief right away," Cutts told Kelly's assistant. Once inside, Cutts explained he couldn't stomach seeing McMaster, a rock-ribbed professional and a role model, go down so that he, a relatively low-level staffer, could remain. "I beg of you, don't let McMaster do this," Cutts told Kelly. "I'm resigning." But Kelly shook his head emphatically. "No, no," Kelly said. "You're great. Just keep doing what you're doing. What are you talking about?" Cutts blinked. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. Trump was insisting that McMaster fire the leakers. Hannity had fingered McMaster's deputies as the guilty parties. The president's alt-right fans on the internet were openly accusing Cutts by name, even though an earlier internal investigation ruled out both him and Bajraktari because neither ever had access to the document. And still, here was Kelly, standing in front of Cutts and insisting that both he and the president wanted him to stay. At the same time, or shortly after, Trump called McMaster, summoning him to the phone and away from his meetings with foreign leaders. Trump was terse. He said something to the effect of, "I think it's time for you to leave." "Yes, Mr. President, I understand," McMaster said. "How quickly do you want me to go?" "Friday," Trump replied, meaning the next day. McMaster suggested a more structured handoff, perhaps over a 2-week period, so that he could share briefing materials with his successor. Trump said that would be fine, but he wanted to announce the change immediately. McMaster quickly called his core team of NSC advisors to gather for a conference call. He wanted them to hear the news from him before Trump tweeted it. When they all hung up, McMaster's two top deputies, the ones accused of the leak, sent Kelly an email informing him they were tendering their resignations, effective when McMaster left his office. It took only a few minutes for Trump to announce his own news. The tweet posted at 6:26 p.m. "I am pleased to announce that, effective 4/9/18, @AmJohnBolton will be my new national security advisor. I am very thankful for the service of General H.R. McMaster, who has done an outstanding job and will always remain my friend. There will be an official contact handover on 4/9. McMaster did not go quietly, however. During the 2-week handoff period, he delivered a stinging rebuke of Trump's Russia policy. On April 3rd, in a dinner speech at the Atlantic Council, McMaster denounced Russia's aggression around the world and said the United States was falling short in confronting it. "Russia has used old and new forms of aggression to undermine our open societies and the foundations of international peace and stability," McMaster said. "For too long, some nations have looked the other way in the face of these threats. Russia brazenly and implausibly denies its actions, and we have failed to impose sufficient costs." Earlier that same day, Trump said during a news conference with the leaders of the Baltic states that he was hopeful of forging an alliance with Putin. "Ideally, we want to be able to get along with Russia," the president said. McMaster made clear he saw little virtue in getting along with Russia. "Would you rather be part of a small club of autocrats that might rotate their meetings between Moscow, Tehran, Damascus, Havana, Caracas, and Pyongyang? Or would you rather be a club of free peoples who respect sovereignty, individual rights, and the rule of law? He told the Atlantic Council. I think our club is better. The audience burst into applause. The Atlantic Council's president, Frederick Kemp, congratulated McMaster for that ringing voice of clarity. This was the last time McMaster spoke publicly as a member of the Trump administration. The tumult on Trump's legal team mirrored the chaos in his White House, a virtual tilt-a-whirl, with the president pressing the buttons like a carnival ride operator. Joe DiGenova, the lawyer Trump had announced he was hiring based on his Fox News appearances, lasted less than 1 week. On March 23rd, Trump met with DiGenova and his wife, Victoria Tenzing. The couple, both seasoned lawyers with solid track records, came as a package, but Trump told aides he was less impressed with them than he had expected. He explicitly ruled out Tenzing speaking for him on television, complaining that she showed up in the Oval Office wearing a flowing bohemian-style wrap and fingerless gloves. DiGenova, meanwhile, wore an ill-fitting suit. Trump envisioned killers as his lawyers, and DiGenova and Tenzing simply did not have the look. Trump found a face-saving way to back out of hiring DiGenova and Tenzing without directly offending them. The couple had responsibly flagged for the president a potential conflict of interest that he would need to be aware of if they represented him. They also represented Mark Corallo, the former spokesman for Trump's legal team, who was a potential witness in the probe into the president's possible obstruction of justice. For DiGenova and Tenzing to continue, Trump would have to be aware of the Corallo conflict and agree it did not concern him. Jay Sekulow announced March 25th that DiGenova and Tenzing would no longer be joining the legal team. Sekulow had been expecting to eventually downsize his own role in the Trump legal battle, and though an avid fan of the president, he never planned to lead his legal defense team. But after a week of turmoil, Sekulow, a rock music fan, adopted a zen attitude and a gallows humor to try to roll with the punches. "Welcome to the Hotel California," Sekulow said in a joking reference to the Eagles hit, when a colleague asked him what the turnover meant for him. "You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave."